This podcast is sponsored by El Spilio, makers of some of the finest caving headlamps on the planet. And if you want to get your own El Spilio, you can save $20 off any regularly priced headlamp with the promo code podcast at elspilio.com. And I put a link to elspilio.com in the description of this podcast, if that helps. But it's just elspilio.com. You can figure it out. Or any order of $300 or more, you can get that $20 off, again, with the promo code podcast. And when you think about the investment that you have to make in some other hobbies, spending a good amount of money on a light when it's one of the most important things you carry, I mean, it just makes sense. What's the biggest investment in caving? Time and travel? Some people spend a lot of money on gear, and that's fine. They can go more places than those who don't. And these lights are worth your while. Elspilio.com. And of course, Lane Roberts in Texas is currently borrowing my Elspilio Lunatic because she can take it places I won't be able to, with two kids and not enough time to cave. So she's been sharing updates with me. She's ridge walking in the High Quads this month. She's checking out some new caves in Texas. Plus, she hosted a bunch of Indiana cavers at Caverns of Sonora recently, where she works as a guide. So that light is being put to good use. And thank you for showing our Indiana friends a good time there at Caverns of Sonora. And if you get a chance to go there, it's a pretty incredible cave, and maybe Lane will be your guide. Thank you, Lane, for the updates. And well, eventually, she's going to send that light back to me if you want to be the next recipient to try out the Elspilio Lunatic, their top-of-the-line light. Just send me an email. You can find me in the NSS directory. And again, if you just want to get your own light, go to elspilio.com and enter the promo code podcast at checkout to save $20 on any of their lights. This is the Caving Podcast. Welcome to it. My name is Matt Pelser, former chairman of the Central Indiana Grotto, current active member of the Central Indiana Grotto and the NSS and Indiana Karst Conservancy and one or two other grottos. You know how it goes. If this is the first time you're listening to the podcast, great. If you've never been caving before, great. Here's what you need to know. It can be really, really fun if you know what you're doing, but it can be dangerous if you don't. So I would encourage you, if you've never done it before, to get hooked up with your grotto. There's that word again. Grotto is like a local chapter of the National Speleological Society. And because caving is so specific, and what you need in order to do it isn't exactly easy to figure out for a first-timer, we encourage you to go with people who know what they're doing, and they're happy to share all the information you're going to need in order to make it a fun, safe trip. And you get a few of those under your belt, and you can start leading your own trips. So get in touch with your local grotto. I've got a link in the description of this podcast on how you can do that at the NSS website, caves.org. That's easy to remember, right? Caves.org. My guest this month is Executive Director of the Missouri Bat Census, Kirsten Alvey Mudd, and I've been wanting to talk to her for a while, and we had a great talk. If you know Kirsten, you know she can talk, and that's great for me. I can just sit back and listen. So we'll get into that here in just a little bit. I did get to go caving this past month. I took one little, well, I guess you could call it two trips, because I did them back-to-back in the same day. Went to Buckner, my usual hangout. Took three noobs. It was a great trip. We were going to have like a 10-person group. And you know how it goes. A bunch of people dropped out, and we had a lean four-person group. It was really, really nice. We just did the circle route, if you're familiar with Buckner, and popped up into the volcano room. That was it. Came out. And we had a couple people with us who had rappelling experience and who had gotten a crash course in climbing rope. And so we went to a little pit afterward, and they did their first pit cave. And they did great, every one of them. I wasn't concerned for the safety of any of them. They listened. They paid attention. I always get nervous taking people vertical caving, you know, because their life is in your hands. And that's the thing to remember, now, obviously, for a lot of reasons. But they felt safe. I felt safe. It was a good group. Oh, and other outdoor stuff. I took a huge hike in Indiana's largest state park, Brown County, which a lot of people go to see the leaves, a lot of leaf gazers in the fall. And it was peak time. This was early November. And I hiked 23 miles in one day. Maybe that's not a lot for you, but that's a lot for me. It might be the biggest single day I've ever had on the trail. I've had some days that have come close, and maybe I've had some days that have gone over that, but I'm pretty proud of that. And truth be told, I did it because I got some tough personal news this month. My mom got cancer, kidney cancer, and she's, you know, healthy as a horse otherwise. So I kind of had to hike that off my mind a little bit, process that on the trail. Good to go caving when you got a lot on your mind too, right? But she had surgery this month and actually just the other day went home. They snipped out her kidney and they're going to put her on some mild chemo to make sure they got everything. And I think she's going to be all right. It seems like everything's good, but I've heard from a few caving friends who know about this, and I appreciate the kind words. It's been tough, but the horizon is bright. So thanks. Oh, and I guess we've come to the end of another year. I didn't get 50-50 male-female guests on the podcast this year, but, you know, we came kind of close. And we had a few weird episodes, you know, where we had a couple of people or several little interviews, and I think changing it up like that is good. So here's to 2022. So let's hear this month's guest. She's the executive director of the Missouri Bat Census, and you can find them on Facebook. I put a link to their Facebook page in the description of this podcast, and later she shares how you can help out. As you might imagine, as is the case with a lot of caving organizations, volunteer work is the bread and butter. So listen for that later on in the interview. Okay, here she is, a great talk, Kirsten Alvey Mudd. So your, like, hangout as a kid was Murphy's Cave?
It was. As a kid, you don't really know what the hell you're into, but when I then became adult, I was like, oh, holy crap. And I still go into it now. I mean, we still do surveying it now. Last October, a landowner that had bought some property that abuts it actually accidentally backhoed into it while he was widening out a driveway area and opened a new hole. And I was one of the first handful to be back into it near the original barrel entrances in over 50 years, which was really cool.
Wow. Okay. So, I don't know, any concerns with that new entrance?
Oh, yeah. It's, Hannibal Shale it's a blue shale that you literally touch it and it just disintegrates. And so it's kind of like working with dry quicksand is what I like to say, because it'll bring an entire wall in down and around you if you're not careful. And so what we went into was kind of sketchy in the first place, and we spent a couple of days in there doing some work and doing some digging, trying to decide exactly where his new entrance was at in retrospect to the old map that had been drawn in the 60s. It was very entertaining. I went back in the spring to try and get back in again, and because it was no longer frozen, it was super sketchy. There had been a minor collapse already, and we told him no. We said, no, we're not willing to go back in. Perhaps this is one that we can only push during the wintertime, when particularly around that entrance area and that first, 1,500 feet where the air blows in and blows out so much, where all that Hannibal Shale has a chance to be thoroughly frozen. And, you know, it's not, that's going to be the most solid it's ever going to get is the dead of winter for us. Mm. And so we haven't really been back into that one since, but we know where it connects in to the original Murphy's Cave. I used to be able to go to what I can utilize now as an adult and go all the way across over to where I believed as a kid anyway, where the barrel entrance was at. You know, you look back at a map after you're an adult in your memory and try and go, was I here? Was I here? And it's a little sketchy on whether you're, super accurate if you're there or not. And I definitely can't make through some of the restrictions I used to as a kid. There's a couple in there that are like, 5-6 inch restrictions. And, I could clear that when I was, 9, 10 and 12, but it's not happening as an adult now. So, yeah, it's a sweet little cave to go and play in. It's quite the maze.
What's the surveyed length of Murphy's at this moment?
Oh gosh, you would ask me something like that. It was back in the 60s, and I've got a map here somewhere. It's a massive amount of cave under one hillside at multiple levels, and almost all of it is hands and knee and belly crawling. There's a couple of areas where you can stand up and walk for short distances, and it's all crevassing. Mm. So it's all real narrow, funky, weird crevice passages, which is really, it's fun. I mean, that's what I grew up in. So for me, it doesn't faze me too much.
Yeah. So, as a kid, going through Murphy's Cave, not our definition of exploration, but for you, you were exploring it as a first timer. How far did you get when you were a little kid?
When I was a little kid, we'd spend hours in there. It was my childhood clubhouse. So, I lived in that thing. You just go in and you just take off. And when I first started caving, I had that giant double Ever Ready battery that you had to screw like this car headlamp onto the front of.
Yeah.
Oh my God. The thing weighed 9,000 pounds. No wonder I have arms like a Russian athlete. It's from dragging that thing around my entire youth, And I caved in a freaking St. John's Lutheran sweatshirt, sweat dog sweatshirt and jeans. I didn't even have a helmet for the longest time. I remember One of my friend's dads worked at what was then Cyanamid, which was a plant. There's a lot of industry up in that area. It was a plant up in that area. And I remember he had a helmet that he gave me when I was like 8. So, I mean, I spent the first couple of years caving without even a helmet. My parents didn't go. It was the 70s. You went outside when it was daylight. You were kicked out of the house. Your mom wanted you gone, you know. You were told what time to be back, and you better be back by that time, you know. And you just kind of ran the hillsides. And I remember for my 9th birthday, I asked my parents, of all things, you know, little girl, and I asked my parents for a carbide light because I had been reading about carbide lights.
There you go.
Sure as crap, my dad and mom got me a carbide light for my 9th birthday. I was, you know, from then on, it was like game on. You couldn't keep me out from underground. There was not a hole in Northeast Missouri that I could not reach from the banana seat of a blue bicycle. I kid you not. We'd scheme to go down to friends' houses because we knew there was a hole that blew air out. Me and a couple of guys that I had spent most of my, you know, childhood playing with. You know, it was a good childhood. That's just what we did. It was a different era. I mean, you know, people hear about it down there like, oh my God, your parents let you down there. It would have been really hard to stop, you know, some of us when we were kids in that era. You just couldn't, you know.
It was a beautiful time of freedom and youth.
I feel bad for kids now.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, absolutely.
Yeah, they explore this, you know, video world and the Minecraft and all these games they play online and stuff. But it's not real exploration.
I'm not terribly familiar with Hannibal other than, you know, just the Mark Twain history and things like that. I've never been there. I have this sort of picture in my mind that there are just caves everywhere. Is that the truth?
Yes and no. I mean, 5 blocks from my house going south was Ides Hill, which is Murphy's Cave, and it actually has 3 separate entrances even now to this day. The next hillside over to it is actually where the limestone quarries are that are now Sedalis Nature Preserve. We played in those quarries as kids. That's the nature preserve with the endangered bat species that I rediscovered as an adult. You know, just a mile and a half from there down through a road cut bluff is Cameron and Mark Twain Caves. Just down from that is Labom Caves. The summer camp I played at Okotipi had a cave in the camp and one just off the camp property. There was, you go north of where I was at, and there was 3.5, almost 4 blocks, and there's 6 caves there that sit in various little holes and hollows. So, yeah, I mean, it wasn't like you could throw a stone and hit a cave everywhere you went, but there was a lot of them there.
And let's go back to this bat population that you discovered that's now the former quarry, now the Sedalis Nature Preserve. What was that like coming across that? And when did that happen?
The discovery was in 2012. Okay. So I played in this quarry most of my entire childhood. I found it, I'm wanting to say I was like 7 maybe when I found that quarry, maybe 8. And we'd go up there and we'd hang out. It was, you know, cold in the summer and warm in the wintertime. It was great to go. And it was bigger than Murphy's. So, I mean, it's quarry. It's 20-foot ceilings in many cases and 40 in some areas. So it was big, massive. It wasn't, you know, hands and knee and belly crawling. And it was wide open. You could ride your bicycle through it. It was great. In 2012, I had just retired and was doing more full-time work and volunteer work with U.S. Forest Service. Dr. Sybil Amelon is a good friend of mine. And I have been doing field and technician work, a lot of their field work for them for a number of years. She's not a big caver. She will cave if she has to for a project. But if it, you know, when it comes to the down and dirty, getting it done quick and fast and appropriate, I'm usually the one, you know, that will go in and go underground and do a lot of what she needs done. So I went up in 2012 and had a whole list of caves. I had been going through our state database and had a whole list of caves and quarries that I wanted to go to as an adult after we had retired to look at former bat populations that had been existent in places. And so I was working on these gray bat populations primarily and looking for, we knew that gray bats cyclically would stop using certain caves, but then maybe 10, 15 years later start using them again. So I was going back through the historic records and locating some of these spots. We'd also noticed that they were increasingly more using quarries. So I had listed a whole bunch of quarries that I knew of as a kid and had hit up a lot of people about quarries and was starting to work on getting landowner access. I was up in Hannibal primarily, while we were doing this, Dr. Amelon was looking for little brown bats. She wanted to bring them in for some of the captive laboratory studies that we were doing for white nose research with the Rhodococcus rhodocros inhibitant. And so in order to pull as many bats as we needed from the wild and be able to bring them into a lab setting, you have to have a very large population. You can't cull too many of it because it can cause a colony to collapse if you take too many of the population. So, you know, I'm up there. We had done another quarry in town and found a decent number of bats, a few of the little browns that we wanted, a few Sodalis that were in that quarry. And I was set to go to up to what is now Sodalis. And Shelley Kalatsky with Missouri Department of Conservation was supposed to go with me, too. She's one of my best friends. She ended up having to go home, had a migraine. So my now husband and I were dating, and he and I went up, and he went with me, and walked into the quarry, and I'm just walking in the same entrance I went into as a kid. You know, it's kind of a surreal thing. Everything seems shorter now because you're taller as an adult.
Yeah.
And, you know, the memory's starting to come back because I don't think I had been in that quarry since last time I was probably 16 or 17. I mean, you know, you move away from your hometown, and it was small town America, so I kind of fled for the city and didn't really come back. You know, you came back for weddings and funerals, and that was about it. I came back, walked in, and just doing the thing, the route I remembered going to as a kid, and I'm looking up, and there's clustering bats, like the second room in. And this is a 20.1 mile quarry. This is a massive quarry.
Wow.
And I'm going, I'm looking at these clusters, and I'm going, go forward another room or two. And you kind of go up an area. When you start in, it's like 25, 40 foot ceilings. And then you're going up a backfill rise, and suddenly you're standing with bats right here. The ceiling's like just a foot above you. And I'm staring, you know, nose to nose with clusters of endangered Indiana bats. And I kind of do a little bend down and look where I can skim the quarry ceiling, and they're as far as the eye can see.
Wow.
I have been dealing with bats since I was in college. I did bat work in Mexico. I've seen large populations, and I had never in my life seen this many bats in a location, even working with grays. And
by that time, sorry, WNS hadn't made it.
On our horizon.
Okay.
Yeah, it was in 2010. It arrived here in Missouri through swabbing. We picked it up on swabbing samples. And actually that same winter in 2012 was the first time that visible was found. Mm. Had not yet been found at the time that I discovered these bats, you know, rediscovered the bats up in this quarry.
Yeah.
I'm sitting here in my brain when I'm looking at these bats, and I told my husband, I said, it was a horrible hill that we had to climb to get up there. You couldn't really drive up there. The roads were in bad condition. I said, I need you to go back down to the car and get my cell phone. He's like, what's going on? I said, I need to take some pictures, and I need to send them off to some people like in a hurry. So he hikes back down to get it. I'm just kind of wandering, you know, with my chin dragging the floor because my mouth's open so far through sections of the quarry with my brain, you know, remembering the path and everything. Growing up in maze caves, I don't really get lost, and things come back. It just takes me a few minutes to pick up markers. And I'm noticing bands on some of the bats, and I know the significance of bands as a bat biologist. So I'm trying to look at the band numbers, but I don't want to disturb them. I know how disturbable they are. So I'm stacking rock cairns up underneath clusters that have bats with bands on them so I can go back and take pictures of them and not lose track, because there's that many clusters of bats in this quarry. And I'm just in one section of this. I know how big this quarry is. I played in it. And so he got the camera and got back up there eventually, and I snapped a few shots and went back out because I wasn't going to spend a lot of time in there. I know their significance. I know the protocols surrounding them as an endangered species, and sent a couple pictures off to Shelley, who was home with the migraine. And I don't think the last one even got through when my phone rings, and she's like, where the hell are you at? And I'm like, of course I told you that. She goes, those are Indiana bats. That's one of the biggest clusters of Indiana bats I've ever seen in my life. She did her graduate work on banding Indiana bats and doing Indiana bats.
She missed it.
So she tells me this. I'm going, yeah, I know. And she said, that's huge. She said, that's like 500 bats in that cluster. She said, I don't think I've ever seen that many in one setting. I said, Shelley, keep going through the pictures. Call me back in a minute. So I hang up. She calls me back and she goes, oh my God, are those all clusters? Because I sent her one of those skim the ceiling pictures. And I said, yeah. I said, Shelley, they're as far as the eye can see up here. I've never seen this many bats in a location outside of Texas and going down to do some work down there. And she goes, oh my God, I can't believe I'm at home with a migraine today. I'm like, well, we got to get you back up here. She said, "Are you making calls or am I making calls?" And I'm, because, you know, the bat world's kind of small. We all know each other, especially here in our state. And so she started making phone calls to U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. I started making phone calls. Shelley was just interim with NDC at the time. Bill Elliott had just retired as their bat biologist and bat cave ecologist. I made a phone call to him. And, you know, we kind of got the ball rolling, and 5 days later, we had a small group of five of us went back up there for the official confirmation that they were an endangered species and a large volume, and it was pretty amazing. I mean, I had played in this as a kid. It was a reason I kind of had wanted to go back and target some of these. I remembered these being what I thought was little brown bat populations, which is what Dr. Amelon was looking for. Did a research project when I was like 9 or 10. The local librarian had helped me look up about bats, and it was '70s. There's no Google. You're not pulling the internet for stuff. There really wasn't a lot of published to the public paper available on Indiana bats, period. You know, bats at all. Indiana bats, there was next to nothing. So we just assumed they were little brown bats. I did a whole paper on it in ninth grade and got some science medal on it from it, you know, when you do the little local science fair stuff. So for me, they were Indiana bats. And, you know, if you stop right now and think back to when you were 9, can you remember what a species of salamander is that you looked at on the ground? Probably not. They're calling me, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is going, "Well, how long have you known these bats were there?" And I'm like, "Well, it's not like I knew they were endangered. I'm digging through the attic looking for Holly Hobby and Nancy Drew freaking diaries because I was a journaler, and I'm looking for notes I took back in the 1970s where I had drawn pictures of animals and creatures and dates I had been to things." And, you know, thank goodness my parents were one that encouraged journaling and that kind of stuff, because we literally used Polaroid camera pictures, pictures from Brownie camera, you know, the old Brownie cameras that I had Brownie cameras that were tucked into my Holly Hobby diaries to retro this bat population now into the historical files. So if you pull up the Indiana bat history on the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service page and it shows you the population history, you'll notice a little asterisk on there, and it talks about a newly discovered hibernacula discovered in 2012, but they've retroed those numbers back with an asterisk all the way back into the 70s and 80s because I had, you know, not official documentation of the full 200,000 that's there, but I had enough documentation to be able to show that, you know, there was a significant size population.
Wow.
Which was, it was a cool thing when you sit back as an adult and you go, "So crap I was doing when I was 9, you know.
Now is significant.
Yeah, and you know, it's part of why when I started the organization that I started, that education is like a key thing for me, and doing a lot of work with the youth and getting elementary school, high school students underground. You know, they may not become a bat biologist or cave ecologist. They may actually not become a caver. But as long as they're respectful of what is there and they're not shredding, you know, everything behind them in nature, you never know when they're going to have the next big discovery and not know about it until they're an adult too. And so it kind of changed a little bit of the goals for the organization as I first set it up, and made me focus, refocus things a little bit more on education and more on reaching out and making people understand that, you know, even 9-year-olds can have a significant impact. You just may not know it yet.
Knowing what you know about that species and about that site in particular, and, you know, looking back in your journals and kind of applying it to what you rediscovered in 2012, what do you then glean from that as far as how this population got started and how long it's been there? Do we know? Do we have enough information to be able to answer those questions?
You know, they're still working on that. There's some unique climate studies that we've been doing up there. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has been doing up there over the last year or so, looking at the air take, the air inflow, and the temperature fluctuations, and why are the bats liking this quarry? Why, even with WNS known in this quarry for the last several years, is this group's population not really having any significant change?
That was my next question. How much has WNS impacted it since then? Because it hadn't quite made it there by that point.
So, and that was a huge concern. Protecting the site was a huge concern because, I mean, there were people running ATVs through there and driving vehicles in there. Mm. When we were mapping it, before we actually had the purchase and the acquisition finished, when Cave Research Foundation was up there mapping it, we were 1.5 miles back in the quarry in the middle of nowhere. And we're going, what is that? Headlights? And it's a vehicle, a truck has driven all the way back in the quarry back there, and it's private property. They didn't even have permission to be there. It was just so frequently, you know, people just were on it willy-nilly, and the landowner had given up. I mean, you know, after so many years of banging your head against the wall, you can't be every place at once on something that big. So we had a lot of concerns about how do we protect it. You know, you gate a site, especially a site that big, there's 34 entrances on it. It was one of, if not the largest angle iron gating project in the world. A massive amount of angle iron went up there to get that thing gated. We know with gray bats, when you gate sites, sometimes you have problems. They don't, you know, they abandon a site. So there were a lot of concerns when this happened. Since then, you know, we've looked at hydrology. We've looked at the geology. We're looking at, they're looking at the air inflow. They're looking at the temperature variation between inside the quarry and outside the quarry, how the barometric pressure affects things in there. You know, do they like it because they could hang near the outer edge, or if it starts to get too cold or too warm, they've got plenty of space underground without having to risk, you know, being outside and moving around in nature during the dead of winter and with predators, that they can shift, and they do shift within the quarry. There's a lot of completely unanswered questions. I mean, you know, as highly disturbable as Indiana bats are, that quarry took on a lot of people for a lot of decades, yet they still used it. I think it's just one of those sweet spot sites. I mean, every state kind of has a couple of sites that are their sweet spots, you know, that for whatever reasons, it's got the perfect combination. It's like the perfect storm. It's got the perfect little bit of everything you like. And even though, you know, sometimes the neighbors might be a pain in the butt, they still like to be there. You know, as far as the site itself goes, that, you know, it was only discovered in 2012.
Yeah.
We didn't actually acquire the property until 2016 is when the property was closed on from the private landowner. And within a year of that, it was opened as a city park in Hannibal. It has got a paved walking route that goes to a large portion of the entrances. It is one of the prides of the Hannibal Parks and Recreation System. My fellow citizens and the folks that I grew up with there in Hannibal have embraced it. They will make a phone call to the police department, to Parks and Rec, if they see any, you know, kids up there playing on the gates, banging on the gates, anything that is out. They have really taken pride and possession in making sure that the bats up there are protected and taken care of. And that's a real win-win, because when you keep these things as hidden, you know, and off the beaten path, you run a lot more risks of somebody being able to sneak in or there being unknown damage to it. Whereas you've got a 25,000 to 50,000 person police force that's wandering up on that property on a regular basis that keeps an eye on what's going on up there, which is pretty sweet.
So in this post-WNS world, what are your main concerns at the moment? What are your areas of focus? If we could kind of give you the whole slate of things.
So WNS, you know, it kind of wreaked havoc in our state. It kind of started up a little bit more up there in our northeast area where things get colder quicker. Missouri's got kind of three unique climate belts. Our northeastern region and a little bit of our northwestern region gets those really cold, you know, like the northern Iowa, Minnesota, they get those cold, nasty winters. Where I live here in the middle Missouri area, we kind of get that nice little mix. We get winter, but yet you'll somehow end up with like an 80 degree day in January for a couple of days.
Mm-hmm.
When you get down below the Lake of the Ozarks area and down into southern Missouri, you get more of the Arkansas, northern Texas, Tennessee, you know, lower Tennessee, Alabama region weather, where there's not so much snow. You get it every now and then. You get more of the ice mix if you get anything. But, you know, sometimes you go weeks on end where it's still 50 or 60 degrees out in the wintertime. So it kind of worked its way from the north and swept through to the southwest. And because my organization, we have over 800 caves that we manage, caves and quarries mixed here in the state. We've got them spread out throughout all areas of the state. So I was in this unique perspective of caves in northeast Missouri that had WNS and were 5, 6, and 7 years post-WNS, populations that had tanked, and still had caves down in southwest Missouri where either WNS had not been seen visibly or we were not seeing the mortality rates down there yet that we'd had in the Northeast. So I had this huge array, And, you know, your emotions, they're up 1 minute and they're down the next when you're in the bat world, because I've got populations in Northeast Missouri where we have lost 99.99999% of the northern long-eared bat population. We used to, you know, maybe see 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 in the wintertime. I saw 8 in the entire state the last couple of winters. And those were at the time in one cave that we managed in the private setting in Southwest Missouri. And so it's a strange thing when you're watching the calamity and you're slowly watching it transpire throughout your entire state. The only thing that has kind of saved me was in the last couple of years, we've had the rebounding populations. So we have sites in Northeast Missouri where if there were even the smallest population of bats left after WNS came through, they've slowly started to rebuild. Over the last several years, you know, the populations would bottom out around the between 95 and 99% loss on some of the bats, tricolors, little browns, northern longears in particular. And if there was any of those species left, they've started to rebuild. Their numbers within the last 2 or 3 years have slowly but steadily continued to rise within those hibernaculas. And so you get the positive end on one end, but you're still watching things tank on the other end. So it's kind of a unique perspective to be able to be in one location and monitor a broad spectrum of it. I'm very hopeful that some of our bats are rebounding. They really are. It makes you, I kind of temper it. I hate making the 6-hour drive from Southwest Missouri to Northeast Missouri, which frequently seems to happen. I tell myself not to do it on the schedule, and yet I find myself doing it every winter. But it, when you're down there, you know, walking into a cave, you used to know had 1,400, 1,500 bats in it, and it wasn't a big cave, you know, mileage wise in the first place. And there's, you know, 70, your heart sinks, you know, you end up really crying sometimes when you come out of caves. I've walked into caves and the entrances have been littered with what you're like, oh, look, bats. And you're, you know, in your mind, you're going, that's not a good thing. Cause you know, when they move towards the entrances that they've probably got WNS, that they're either seeking a way out to find food or they're seeking colder temperatures to try and drop the thermal reaction that WNS causes in their system and force their bodies back down into a hibernating temperature. And then you look up and realize that half of them that are hanging there are already dead. They're hanging dead, or wow. They're hanging there with I have photos, if you dig around on my Facebook page for Bat Census, of bats with their entire metabolic system is just completely collapsing. A combination of blood and bile and things is just oozing from their eyes, from their ears, from their wings. It's horrible. The 3 years that I worked a lot in the laboratory, I like to say those are my 3 winters with no sleep. I was working with Dr. Amelon, and because a lot of my background is in captive bat support and neonate pup care, I did a lot of helped with a lot of the support work in the laboratory setting, the bats that had to be cared for. And so we were in dealing with bats, both in treatment groups that were surviving WNS because of the inhibitant working, to groups that were the control groups that, you know, every time you'd open a hibernation chamber or every time you'd look at a hibernation film, you'd see another one that was dead. From a caver perspective, I mean, a lot of cavers, they get angry and they get upset because these caves are closed for this and these caves are closed for that. And they see their bats missing, but they really have not been hands-on seeing the actual what happens to the bats. And I had a very, it kind of makes you choke up just thinking about it, a very heartfelt, and it was very painful working with the labs and the bats. The bats in the labs, because you were physically seeing exactly what they went through with WNS and every state. And that's pretty, it's pretty eye-opening. It brings it, you know, straight to you pretty fast. And so when I have friends and I have people that I know that get very upset about that, I like to, you know, send them pictures and say, you know, if this was what was happening to you, wouldn't you want, you know, to have a little peace and a little quiet and just get a chance? And it kind of can change people's perspective. So again, it's about the education, making sure that people actually understand what happens to the bats when they have WNS, and why us not disturbing them so much in the wintertime is really critical. I mean, it really is.
I would say if you could say something then to cavers, because a lot of cavers listen to this, along those lines. I mean, if you could boil it down and simplify it, what would you say then? Just if you are headed to a known hibernaculum, maybe think twice.
I like to say, you know, just don't. We're very lucky that here in Missouri, we try to coordinate our efforts. We have a lot of caves. I mean, granted, we don't have as many caves as another state does, but we do. Always the argument.
Yeah, know? Yeah. And we'll get to that here in a second, but I'll let you finish answering this question.
So we do try and coordinate a large number of grottos and Cave Research Foundation and, you know, the government organizations, our organization, general, just free cavers, independent cavers that are out there. We do try to organize over the winter season in particular to try and make sure that caves are only entered once, that each cave is only entered once during the winter, and that whether it's a mapping team that's in doing a project or they're, you know, doing whatever in there, that a biological inventory is being done at the time and that it's one trip and it's done, and that, you know, you try and respect the bats while you're in there. If you're in a room with a large bunch, move through it quietly. You don't need to go through like a herd of elephants that, you know we can all do it. We've all done it caving. Just try and learn to be more respectful when you're there. Try and not overuse a cave. In general, as cavers, we all know those ones that are sacrificed, the ones that are just, they've just been walked until there's an elephant trail, like a 4-lane highway through them. Using just some standard cave conservation and cave ethics, applying and just say no. Talk to your fellow cavers around you. Talk to your fellow grottos. Say, hey, you know, we've all been in such and so cave. Can't, you know, let's all pick a variety of different caves, and we all go to different caves this winter. You know, we share and share alike to make sure that we all get a chance to get underground. We take people that aren't professional cavers, shall we say, that aren't, you know, biological researchers and managers, that are just recreational cavers with us during our winter trips. I want cavers to get underground. I enjoy being underground. They can do their recreational caving while I'm doing my biological monitoring. I don't want to say just say no, just learn how to do it properly. Mm-hmm. It can be done. There has always been the ability for there to be a balance between the biological usage and needs of a cave and a cave's inhabitants and the cavers that enjoy it. There is always the ability to do that. It takes work. It takes effort. You have to look at, as a caver in a cave, you have to look at it as a relationship. Like you're having a marriage with this cave. You don't want to, you want it to survive long term. You want your children and your grandchildren to be able to enjoy it. It's not a disposable, you know, it's not a paper plate. You don't want to throw it away. You want it to be there for you to use over and over again. And WNS should be one of those things. It'd be the same way with, you know, aragonite crystals, selenite, you know, the beautiful crystals, you know, I just spent time sitting beside in Cumberland Caverns. If those things and those areas are not respected in a cave, they're gone. I know there's caves here in Missouri. I have plenty of legendary caving friends that tell me about there used to be, you know, crystals the size of your head in these caves, and there's nothing left. And it's not necessarily because cavers of any type intended to destroy them.
Yeah.
Many times it's it's unintentional. We just need to learn to cave softly. You know, we all say it, but what does it really mean?
And that's a good illustration, I think, for at least some of the reason why us cavers can be, you know, secretive and things like that. Because I like to take a lot of newer people caving. And when they get into it and they sort of learn that about cavers and caving, that's kind of a turnoff for some people. But I always try to explain some of the reasoning. And I think that should be near the top of the list. It's just, you know, we've got to respect these places. They are fragile for a lot of different reasons.
Treat a bat like you would treat a beautiful gypsum flower. You don't want to touch it. If you get too close to it, a selenite needle, and breathe on it, sometimes they'll collapse. Mm. So if you just look at treating the environment on a whole like you're walking through cotton and you don't want to disturb anything that's around there, it can be done. And it's different. A lot of people are, you know, they want to go 900 miles an hour through a cave. They want to, you know, have gigantic, huge, bellowing conversations while they're in there. And you cannot do that during a winter survey. You just can't. Summertime, great. You know, as long as there's not a big bunch of endangered Indiana grays hanging around over your head or Mexican free tails, go for it. You know, have a good time. But it's about maintaining a balance and not being selfish. You and I are from a generation that's, you know, we can have our selfish moments, but we're not nearly as selfish as that generation we like to discuss behind us that thinks the whole world is out there for their personal enjoyment and the next generation be damned. So, I wish I knew where the gap happened. Somehow, somebody dropped the ball somewhere in there, and I don't know how it happened.
Well, let's talk a little bit about exploration, if you don't mind. You kind of mentioned the Tennessee rivalry, which I always just find fun. So I don't know. It seems to me, just, you know, being an outsider, and the only cave I've ever been in Missouri is Merrimack Caverns on my way to Branson. But it just seems to me, in talking to people, that there's a lot of potential still there in Missouri. Is there?
There is. There's a lot of untapped territory. We have a lot of properties that are MTNF, Mark Twain National Forest, that are part of things like the Ozark Scenic Riverways, that are LAD Foundation, that are protected virgin forest areas that have not really been explored. That's a lot of the work that Cave Research Foundation does. I leave out for the field this coming week. I usually give a couple of weeks every winter and a couple of weeks every summer to Cave Research Foundation, doing work, you know, in areas down along the Mark Twain National Forest. There's a lot of area that has not been walked. There's a lot of ridgeline. There's a lot of leads list that we, you know, we have a wonderful database here in our state that Scott House designed and that members of Cave Research Foundation keep finding more archival information and getting into that you can read through and you start picking up leads from the 50s and 60s that you're like, did anybody ever go back and check on this? And there's teams that they make a list and they pull those up and they go start, you know, knocking on doors and looking for the private landowner of this site somebody was at in 1956 and walking ridgeline and boom, bingo, there's another set of caves that pops up. So yeah, we grow every year. Our cave numbers increase by a couple hundred caves usually every year, get reported to the Missouri Speleological Survey, which is our repository for cave locations and cave data here in the state. So there's a huge amount of potential here, huge amount. And sinkholes keep opening up every day. We had a brand new one that opened up in 2019. That I was, you know, there was a handful of us, I mean, newly opened. One of our volunteers watched it go from a hole the size of a manhole to a hole the size you could drop a car into.
Wow.
Yeah, we dropped it at 90-foot pit and some of the largest dog tooth spar crystals here in, you know, seen in our state are in it.
Wow.
So they open up constantly. We take out a lot of water down here. It siphons through and funnels through and opens up more passage that, you know, has always been there, but just didn't have a surface opening. And then there's just a lot of stuff, a lot of century farms, you know, things that have been in a family for 100 years or more here. And not unlike cavers, the family's not going to let anybody know there's a cave on that property. That's their own private little whatever. They don't want everybody traipsing through it and wandering through their land. So then when it changes hands to, you know, a younger member of the family or maybe gets sold off, then these things get discovered. And so, yeah, every day, more and more. And I joke about it. I have a lot of Tennessee and Kentucky caving family that are very close friends and family. So, you know, it's like that constant poking your cousin at the family reunions when we're all together.
Yeah. Oh, and they poke back, I'm sure.
Oh, gosh, yes.
Well, so what are the barriers to discovery? I like here in Indiana, some of the most active places or places with the most potential typically sometimes are on state land, and you know there are some state rules right now that keep cavers out of those caves. I don't know, what's it like there? I mean, there's a lot. There's private landowner access, which you've mentioned already, but what's keeping people from finding these right now?
Really not a lot.
Yeah.
You know we kind of joke about it here. If you're complaining that you're not caving here in Missouri, it's mostly because you're just too lazy to get up and do something.
Your fault.
Because It really is. We've had, issues back and forth sometimes with state and fed when it comes to getting permits and things like that. But over the last couple of years, the state has started to get better about getting permits and access for the state-owned property caves. We have Cave Research Foundation has those permits. Private individuals get those permits. If you are caving with a purpose, if you are doing a biological inventory, if you are doing a restoration project, if you are doing a vandalism and cleanup project, if you are, mapping, you can get a permit to these sites. You can monitor these sites. You can have access to these sites, but you have to become part of organized caving and you have to cave properly. You're required to follow decontamination protocols. You're required to submit reports after you've been there. You're required to notify the local agent when you're going to be in and not in on the property. You can't just fly by the seat of your pants, get up and decide you're going caving in an hour, which is a way a lot of people grew up caving. And it makes it harder, but if you want to cave, you can do it. Cave Research Foundation is all over the Mark Twain National Forest in this state. All over. They have more work than they can possibly get done. Every time I go down to work, there is a list of caves. We schedule, I'm scheduled to be out next week down in Winona at the field station. I'll give them another week, the end of January. And we never fail to do less than 40 or 50 caves over the course of 4 or 5 days. I mean, there is that. There is a list, and there's still more. I'm not the only one that goes down. They have, every weekend during the week, all winter long, all summer long, it's out there. You just have to know how to do it properly. You have to become a part of organized caving. You really do in our area in order to get access to these state and federal caves. They want some assurance that the people that are going in those caves have a modicum of respect and are going to follow the rules. That's what they want. They don't want them to continue to be pillaged and plundered and destroyed. And you have to look at it from both sides of it. I know a lot of good people that work in state and federal government, and they have a mandate. They have a job to do. They have a job to protect these. This is what they get paid to do, is to make sure that they're still there for the animals that use them, for the formations that are in them, and for the next generation behind us to still have them as well. And they don't always like what they have to do, but it has to be done.
How much, I guess, of a barrier, speaking of barriers, is that to getting the right people involved with exploration, discovery, things like that? Because, I mean, that is a thing. I mean, you bringing that up just now, I mean, I'm hearing echoes of so many. I've talked to people on one side, frustration that there are too many rules. People on the other side saying maybe there aren't enough rules, things like that. And I'm just like, there's got to be a balance here. Either that or as cavers, we really need to represent ourselves a little bit with a little bit more, care and, take part in the protocols.
Yeah, I'm in a weird perspective because I grew up as a caver. I became a biologist, so I know both sides of this. I work now with, I run an NGO that walks that line, even though it's private lands, but I walk that line between the private and the needs of the private land and helping our private landowner manage their property appropriately and the government. And it's just like other things in life. You have to get a driver's license to drive a vehicle. It's worth it. You want to be able to drive your car. All the state and federal government want to know is that you understand the rules, you're doing it safely, you're not going to endanger other people around you when you're on the road, and they want you to reassure that every couple of years by, whether retaking your test or getting your new driver's license or whatever the case is. We go through that to drive a car because that's something we want to do. But for whatever reason, it's extremely difficult for individuals in the caving community in some cases to want to decontaminate their gear and equipment. It's a matter of, putting some decontaminant in your laundry, washing things, soaking other things for 20 minutes and rinsing them afterwards and letting them air dry. This is not that difficult. I mean, you wash your regular clothes. It's not that much more of an effort for you to maintain your caving gear and your caving equipment the same way. We fill out paperwork for a loan for a house we want to live in. We do every time you go to the doctor's office, you got to fill out another round of paperwork for something. But for whatever reason, applying for a permit is a difficult thing that people don't want to do. And so, you know, some cavers don't like my attitude towards this and others do. I kind of walk a fine line because I see both sides of this picture. And for me, it's part of life. It has become a way of life. I helped develop the decontamination protocols that we started using in our state early on. You know, how could we make this field friendly for cavers? How could we make this so that it was something that we could adapt to everyday life? Because if you make it too complicated and too difficult, nobody wants to do it. You know what I'm saying? It becomes too much of a pain in the butt. And once it, you know, once it becomes a standard operating procedure, you really don't think about it. It doesn't really become a hassle. I mean, I'm used to stripping down next to the side of my car and putting all my crap in a dirty tote or in a dirty bag, and the whole outer layer goes off and goes in there. And, you know, that's just part of it. I don't get back into my car with dirty, nasty equipment. It's either in a bag or it's on the tail, you know, the tailgate piece on my vehicle. You know, 20 years ago, yeah, I probably threw a whole lot of muddy boots into my backseat and then had to clean the mud up and, you know, had to clean the crap up. You know, there's good and bad ends to it as far as maintaining things across the board. It has become such a way of life for me that for me, it doesn't really seem like it's that big of a deal. It really doesn't. U.S. Forest Service, I've been a volunteer with them for 30 plus years, and they have looked for a long time about, you know, the spread of things, whether it's foreign seeds or, you know, whatever it happens to be. A lot of invasive species get moved around because we're hiking in one end of the country and then we're going to another end of the world. You know, we've become such a modern era where we can get on a plane here and we can, you know, in 12 hours, we're in another country. Why are we dragging all of the crap from our country to their country and then the stuff from their country back to our country? You know, if COVID hasn't taught people any lesson, it would be that things can spread pretty quickly and get out of control pretty easily. And why can't we just nip it in the bud with our gear and equipment? It's very simple.
Yeah.
It really is. We all stayed behind that guy when we were younger whose gear and equipment never got washed. And it's not a pretty picture when he starts to sweat again and that stuff does not smell pretty. Who really wants to be in a crawl space with that guy?
No. That's just basic etiquette. Yeah.
It's worse than the Mexican we all ate the night before that revisits at some point in time.
At the wrong time. It's always the wrong time. What's the best trip you've taken in recent memory?
Oh, gosh. In Missouri or
anywhere,
elsewhere?
Anywhere. Because you've been around the last few weeks as we've kind of tried to get this thing going. You've been doing some pretty exciting stuff.
Yeah. I kind of bounce around. I'm very lucky that I have an amazing group of friends. I have, you know, like I said before, I have Tennessee and Kentucky caving family and other states too. But I have caving family all over the United States and all over the globe. But one of my very best friends, Nicole Ridlin, just took over as the general manager out at Cumberland Caverns in McMinnville. She took over there over Memorial Day weekend was when she started her new job. Talk about, you know, hit the ground running, jump into the deep end of the pool. Cumberland Caverns is, my God, it's, I mean, yeah. It is incredible. And, you know, she's been so busy trying to do the management stuff that she needs to do. And her significant other, Brandon, is their head of maintenance out there. She's not gotten to go with him and do as much of the off path, you know, off of their tour route, you know, exploration that she would like to do. And I've been very blessed that when I've gone out to visit them and see them doing other things in the area or just, you know, going out to see them, that I've gotten to do a lot of off path deep in the middle of nowhere, Cumberland Caverns. Brandon will pull up that gigantic, almost 30 miles worth of map and go, let's go up here. And I'm looking where the entrance is and go, yeah, it's about a 3-hour hike to get up there. No worries. Cause you know, we do 2000 feet of belly crawling just to get into something. Yeah. But I'm going, you know, I put up a post, you know, a week or so ago, there is something that gives you this feeling of awe when you know that you are walking in the footsteps of caving legends.
Yeah.
You really are. Some of these, you know, some of the areas in the cave, of course, are, you know, their junctions and their rooms where you go off 9 different directions. And I'm sure there's been, you know, several thousand people probably through them over the years. But some of these places that Brandon has taken me to in the back corner sections of this cave where we're looking for this room looks cool or this says it's a gypsum something. Let's go see what that gypsum looks like. Some of these places probably have not had more than, you know, 10 or 15 people trafficked in them since the 50s when, you know, Roy Davis went in there and mapped them. when they were initially discovered. And there is something for me as a caver that is just so super cool about that. Not just the cool, awesome stuff that you get to see, but just something so inspiring about being able to walk in the footsteps of legends. These are the guys that they literally wrote the books, you know. They were the beginning of exploration, and it's really cool to be able to still see those places that they were at and see them in relatively the same condition that they were in when they saw them, because there's little to no damage. I mean, you're going through air that you're going, I can't even see where there's been a footprint through here. You see a marking on the wall where it says, you know, somebody has been here mapping, or the two bills are in the breakdown room. They've left a note for Roy in carbide on a rock sitting there on the ground, which is cool. But you know that this nasty little meander on your belly through breakdown with a tiny 2 foot wide slit that drops 15 feet below your knees. Don't drop your gear. You're not getting it back. You know, you got to get through this for some couple hundred feet before you pop over. And you're going through this Plinko board of breakdown rooms through some really sketchy stuff. And all of a sudden, Brandon goes, I think I found it. And, you know, you're coming in behind him and, you know, you're speechless. I'm sitting in a room and I am speechless. I can't get out but expletives that probably shouldn't be on a podcast. That's all that comes out of my mouth, you know, and I don't even want to breathe because there's selenite needles all over the place. And I don't want any one of them to collapse because I am there, you know. It's just, there's just cool stuff. And, you know, I know I'm looking at stuff that probably a handful or two of people have seen.
That's incredible.
I mean, I'm staying in Cumberland. You know, here in Missouri, we get gypsum flowers. They're cool. We get, you know, aragonite crystals. They're cool. We randomly will see selenite, you know, tiny selenite that's left in our area. You know, I might see a gypsum flower. I'm lucky if I can see one the size of my fist. I mean, I'm sitting in Cumberland Caverns with gypsum flowers bigger than my head. You know, there were little pockets that we would slide down into in that cave that Brandon and Nicole took me to a section. And my brain was just so overwhelmed. I've got my phone in my hand, which takes great pictures, and I'm trying to take pictures, but your mind is just, oh, that one. You cannot even get focused to figure out where the heck to start taking pictures because your brain is just so overwhelmed with, you know, it's pretty cool.
It's a good problem.
Really is.
You've been.
Oh, yeah. It's horrible. It's awful.
You've been in some pretty cool places. I mean, caving has taken you around the world, whether not in the United States or maybe in your own backyard. What's on your list? What do you want to do next?
Oh, what do I don't want to do next? Well, there's a particular cave which a handful of people know about down in South Central Missouri. That it's a known cave, but this last winter, my intern was in from Colorado on, like, she had just gotten here. She'd had driven like 13 hours and had 5 hours sleep, and 6 hours later, the girl's in 2 inches of airspace in a water crawl with me, you know, popping air bubble in the ceiling to air bubble in the ceiling, because I'm going, the map says that's a sump, but I can see that looks like that goes. And man, we pushed past three sumps with small pocket rooms and opened up into borehole passage.
Beautiful.
But we had a time limit. You know, we left a group behind that didn't want to go through that with us, and so we didn't get to spend but like 2 minutes back there. And I'm like, you go this way, I'm going this way, run as far as you can run. We got to be back here in 2 minutes, and we got to boogie our butt back through what we just came in, because they're going to be worried about us on the other side of this sump. And we didn't get to see very much of it. Never got to, you know, figure out how far it goes. And I'm anxious. I'm really anxious to get back in that, because it's virgin. I mean, you know, virgin passage excites anybody, but it's, you know, it's really cool to know that you're the first one, you know, to see it and the first one to be in it. That one, you know, really, yeah, it's one I want to get back to. I've got, I got a couple of dingers on the list, a couple in Spain, one in France, some places. I'm lucky, you know, Facebook and the internet has given us the ability to have caving friends all over the world now. And so, you know, I have my bucket list of, oh, yeah, I remember I took notes when I saw pictures of this cave. And you told me you had a couch I could surf on when I finally make it to your country. You know, I'm holding you to that, right?
Do it.
And I'm the same way. My kids don't live here anymore. I got two spare bedrooms. And this place has interns and cavers that crash here at my house regularly, you know, when they come into Missouri. The caving community, we're kind of that way. We offer people, you know, whether it's a couch to crash on or a meal or a shower at my house, and you can pitch your tent in my backyard because I don't have a spare bedroom. We're all a pretty friendly group. So, I got things. There's a couple caves in Australia I want to get back to. I did a lot of my foreign caving, shall we say, not in the U.S. as a kid. Dad was in the military, and so
Gotcha.
I did a lot of it. Yeah, a lot of it in my teenage years. My parents separated, and Dad was in bases all over the world. So I kind of got an opportunity to. He'd set up a vacation, and you know, we'd go to a foreign country, and he always set up caves for me. I'd like to get back to Thailand. I really enjoy Thailand. The caves in Thailand are pretty sweet. There's a ton of caves out there.
Well, I hope you make it back to that that one in South Central Missouri, and I hope that that's not seasonally sumped when you go back.
It is. That's why we looked over the history in the cave files, which is the great thing about us having the cave files that we do, is almost every trip that's been made to sites gets registered in there, and so you can kind of look back and say, oh, these guys were only in there in the summer. No wonder they didn't know that there was passage beyond that. Because the water levels are only down in the wintertime.
Yeah, okay.
And so it makes for, it was cold rear-end hike back to the vehicles. We were so cold we had trouble getting the lock back on the cave gate. And then it wasn't a short hike back to the car. It wasn't that bad, but everything was frozen on you, and you're soaking wet by the time you get back there. And, it was entertaining on a 31-degree day, you know. I'm a glutton for punishment.
Aren't we all? Okay, so... Before we wrap this up, I want for anyone who is interested in supporting the Missouri Bat Census to know how to do that.
Oh, well, a lot of our support is, you know, volunteer support. We like feet on the ground running. We like volunteers that want to come here and want to do some caving projects and want to work with us. We want cavers, whether they're in Missouri or from anywhere in the country. I've hosted a lot of NSS cavers that are vacationing here in Missouri or coming to see family. We've gotten them into private sites where they can take family members or get underground while they're here. As long as you give me more than 10 minutes notice that you're coming through the state, I can hook you up with some cave and private lands. As far as general support and monetary support, we're at a lot of the major caving events. You can get on our Facebook page. We accept donations via, you know, credit card, Square, you know, a variety of different ways that you can send in donations. Just seek us out on our Facebook page. Haven't posted in a while because I've either been gone or we've been working on some projects that are, you know, those ones you don't get to share about. We have a lot of those. A lot of times we're working with a researcher, so you can't necessarily post the pictures and post what's going on until that project is, you know, published or wrapped. But anybody that wants to support us, you know, just get out there and join us. That's how the bulk of our support is. We have over 400 volunteers that work on various projects from, you know, installing bat houses to monitoring populations in bat houses. You don't even have to be a caver. If you don't want to get underground or, you know, you got a bad back and old knees that don't really do it for you anymore like they used to, I can find things for you. I'll be getting ready to head to the field and be craziness this winter. So if people want to contact me about getting underground this winter, make sure you do it well in advance and don't, you know, be patient. Cause there are areas where cell reception and internet does not exist here in our state. And I frequently am in them and absolutely enjoy it because then I don't have to communicate with people. I can just cave. Sometimes I end up with a couple hundred emails backed up and I will get to you. It just doesn't always happen right away. So.
Well, Kirsten, I really appreciate your time. Thank you so much for coming on, and thanks for the work you're doing.
Hey, I like what I do. I like to joke that I think I work more now in what is supposed to be retirement than I probably did before. But when you have a real passion for what you're doing and you really enjoy it, it doesn't really seem like work. I'm exhausted, you know, a couple of times a year where I'm like, caffeine, I really need caffeine. And I'm bruised and battered. I like to go through what we refer to as my rigor mortis stage, which is where you get up and you spend the morning counting the bruises, applying the Aleve and the ibuprofen before you head out to apply more bruises for the day. But yeah, I wouldn't trade being a caver, you know, for anything in the world. I am that crazy freaking addicted to you know, there's that smell of the limestone, and they don't make it in a candle. And you just, it's bad. You're like a junkie. You get the shakes, and you get edgy, and you get real snarky with people because you haven't been underground in a while.
You're the real deal, Kirsten. I appreciate it.
My pants go on the same way as everybody else's. You know, that's what I like to say all the time. I get just as muddy as you do.
You have a great week.
It was great meeting you.
Oh, my goodness. Kirsten, how fun was that? Thank you so much. And thank you for listening. Another year of the Caving Podcast in the books. And, of course, we got to thank our sponsors, past and present. Swago at swagogear.com. Get one of those shiny new Swago packs. You do a lot of wet caving, you got to have one of those. Organic Robot Designs, the brick-and-mortar store in Greenfield, Indiana, or the Etsy shop. A lot of caving-related designs on great shirts, cotton blends, moisture wicking, all synthetic, whatever you want. Charlie will hook you up. And if you want to get t-shirts made for your grotto, search Organic Robot Designs. Of course, Elspelio, our current sponsor, elspelio.com. Save $20 on any light when you enter the promo code podcast. And I put a link to elspelio.com in the description of this podcast. I do know who next month is going to be, but I'm not going to tell you. It's a surprise because it's the kickoff to 2022. And dare I say it's a big deal, or it's different anyway. Maybe not a big deal, but different. And if you already know what I'm doing, keep your mouth shut, all right? I don't care. Do whatever you want. But have a great month. Have a great holiday season. And until next time, kill nothing but time.